You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up today is Cyber Monday, a day capping off one of the biggest shopping weekends all year. We're talking to a history professor about consumer culture in the U.S. and how Americans became such big shoppers. Now, people in northern Wisconsin are digging out from a major winter storm that hit the area over the weekend. Duluth, Minnesota, 22 inches. National Weather Service says that's the ninth highest storm total in the city's history. Other places got even more snow, and then there's the wind. Duluth International Airport recorded one wind gust of 54 miles an hour. Schools closed, events canceled, travel was a mess. But conditions are improving, and the weather should cooperate over these next days at least. Danielle Kading is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Superior. Danny, thank you for helping us out today.
Thank you.
What is the latest that you're seeing after you were just dumped with snow?
Well, it's just pretty much par for the course when you live up in northern Wisconsin. So people are just, you know, digging out as best they can. And today, you know, there were still bus routes that weren't running. There were side streets that weren't plowed. You know, when you get snow that's as heavy as that, it just takes a long time to keep the roads clear, and it's hard for city services and plows to keep up with all of that.
Yeah, and you know, Duluth and Superior really work together. They see themselves as these collaborating communities. Duluth is on this big hill, and there's a huge bridge over water that connects these two communities. How difficult is it with just the terrain when we're trying to keep the streets clear with this much snow?
Well, I just know from personal experience that trying to make it down the hill in Duluth, it can be challenging at best. When you've got conditions like this, sometimes you're just sliding around. And that's why, you know, they often tell people to just stay home, stay put, you know, avoid getting stuck, which a lot of people did get stuck. There were a lot of cars that were marooned on the side of the road or the side of the highway. And, you know, on the Minnesota side, they shut down I-35 for a portion from Poplar to Cloquet, just south of Duluth for a time on Saturday night. So it was not, you know, a time when you want to be out traveling. And yeah, there is that difference, too, between the cities that you mentioned. You know, if you look back historically to one of the biggest two-day snowfall totals that we ever had in the Twin Ports, you know, Superior got 45 inches and Duluth got 3 feet. And that was in 1991. So you can definitely pick up 10 inches or lose 10 inches, depending on which side of the river you're on.
Duluth is in St. Louis County. Their public works department said that the weather was so bad that even some plows were getting stuck. So in addition to those vehicles, hard for plows, I imagine then could also be a concern for emergency crews. And even, I guess, the streets not being plowed yet could be a concern.
Yeah, well, I mean, right now they're saying that roads are passable. And Duluth lifted its travel advisory earlier today, but said, you know, still use caution. But, you know, yesterday when I was able to make it out for a little bit in a truck, you weren't going anywhere in a car if you were stuck on a side street. Driving down the road, seeing plows with chains on their tires. And I think if you see a plow with chains on their tires, that's probably pretty serious.
Yeah, things are a big deal. Danny Kading is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Superior, and we're talking about the aftermath of a winter storm that buried swaths of northern Wisconsin in about 2 feet of snow. Certainly want to talk about Bayfield County. The most snow appears to be in Washburn. That's 31 inches. What do you know about the latest there? That's a lot of snow.
Well, I imagine they're digging out just like the rest of us. You know, that was an area too, like around the Bayfield Peninsula, where there were some concerns too about lakeshore flooding. But it doesn't look like that was as much of an issue. They definitely got a lot of snow on the peninsula. Over on the eastern side in Herbster, or I'm sorry, the western side, Herbster saw 23 inches. La Pointe on Madeline Island got 20 inches. There's just a lot of snow and enough for it to go around.
All right. Well, and we also hear some of the lake enhancement or lake effect snow, even when things happen on the eastern shoreline of Wisconsin. So that's certainly something to keep an eye on when you're as far north in Wisconsin as you are.
Definitely you see higher amounts near the lake.
Yeah. Were there widespread power outages? How are people staying safe that way?
You know, not that I heard. I think for a time there was, you know, around 1,200 people who were without power, according to Minnesota Power. But it didn't seem like power outages were the big deal. It, you know, really was the high winds and the heavy snow that just really made travel difficult, if not impossible. And I think plows in Ashland County even stopped running for a time. You know, there were segments of U.S. Highway 2 as you go towards Hurley and then south towards Manitowish Waters on Highway 51 that where travel was not advised. So I think travel was the thing that was probably most affected yesterday.
Worse because it was the Thanksgiving weekend, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Sure. I mean, people that even work for us were trapped up here. So I imagine that there were a lot of people who were experiencing delayed travel plans, whether it was just getting on the road or missing a flight or two. And hopefully they're able to make it back to their destination safely.
And we know you are not a meteorologist, but you did talk with the National Weather Service. What made this such a big storm this weekend?
Well, it was just a really slow moving system, and it had a lot of moisture that it brought with it, and it just kind of hung around and just kind of stalled over the area as it was moving through. And so, you know, they were seeing snowfall rates of 1 to 2 inches an hour. And when you have something like that, it's just really hard to keep up with all of that and make it so that you can get down the road.
Northern Wisconsin saw a lot of closures over the weekend and schools today. Are you expecting schools will be open tomorrow? Or are things kind of getting back to normal?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, classes at UW-Superior were closed, I believe, until 1 today. You know, Superior and Duluth Public Schools were closed today. But I imagine, you know, everybody will be back in school tomorrow and that things will be fairly normal. I mean, this is kind of what everyone expects up here. So I think people plan ahead. Although I will say that the snow was extremely wet and heavy, which just made it even that more difficult to clear, like with if you were shoveling or snow blowing. I know a lot of people on my block, their snow blowers broke and wouldn't work or were constantly clogged because it was just so wet.
And then you couldn't buy any. So that's a thing,
no.
Too. Hey, Danny.
They're definitely sold out.
I appreciate your perspective that this is what's expected, but that doesn't make it easy. So, you know, definitely good work up there, and we really appreciate it and we recognize that. Happy to be spared this time, though.
Yeah. Well, next time it's your turn.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. We got a lot of winter ahead of us. Danny, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks, Keely.
Danielle Kading is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Superior, covering the big snowstorm that moved across northwestern Wisconsin over the weekend. It dropped more than 21 inches in many locations. Washburn even reported the highest amount at 31 inches of snow. Coming up next here on the Ideas Network, we'll look back at how concerns over today's electric scooters sound a lot like the objections to bicycles in the 1800s. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up, electric scooters. They're loved by some city dwellers, despised by, well, other city dwellers. We'll talk about how the debate over electric scooters echoes concerns about bicycles in the 19th century. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the Macy's of the North.
A thrift shop in Wisconsin's Northwoods is a stark contrast to the Black Friday scene. Jane Hampton takes us to the store in Minocqua, where deals on clothing, cabin decor, and all kinds of stuff draw bargain hunters from far and wide.
Minocqua is a tourist town, but the cute little gift stores are blocks away from the St. Matthias Thrift Shop. It's a plain brick rectangle that used to be a public service building. On a drizzly morning, dozens of shoppers are lined up before doors open at 10. Why are you waiting in line in the rain?
Because it's totally worth it.
What's a lucky find?
My best lucky find was a set of dishes. They were like brand new, sold for $100. I got them for $12.
I'm looking for shoes that fit, and socks.
Finally, the store manager, Jan Degner, unlocks the door.
Are you ready?
Yes!
All right, be nice to each other and have a good time.
Okay.
Degner's a little nervous about this day. It's the big dollar-a-bag event when shoppers pay a buck for whatever they can jam into a brown paper grocery bag. The shop gets chaotic.
I'm very particular about how it looks out on the floor, so that it doesn't look junky, so that things look well-arranged like a regular store. Some people call it the Macy's of the North.
The Macy's of the North definitely has a woodsy vibe. Degner's husband, Gene, runs the furniture side of things.
If it's a upholstered chair and it has animals on it, like deer and bear, they love that.
Loons, deer heads, those, and fish mounds are very popular. I think people like to put them up and say they caught them.
Today, though, the hot sellers are dishes, clothing, and toys.
Like, I love to thrift shop. It's thrilling, to be honest.
Winona Careful of Lac de Flambeau has 4 girls under 8, and the St. Matthias Thrift Shop helps with the budget.
My daughters all have birthdays within about a month of each other, too, so it's a tough time of year.
There's nobody in this neck of the woods that should not have boots, not have a coat, not have furniture.
Barbara Dirksen is one of dozens of local volunteers. She and Degner sift through mountains of donations, everything from junk to gems.
One of our volunteers was going through a bunch of socks that came in, opened up one of the socks, and there was a diamond ring in it. You'll find some that have engraving inside, happy anniversary, and those kind of things. Those are sad. There's many a time we've stood out there in the back room and teared up with family members and hugged, and, you know, there's a lot of personal things going on, too.
What happens is when people sell their cottages, they sell it with all the stuff in it because they don't want it. They don't want to take it home to Chicago. They don't want it. And so now new people buy that house. They don't want that stuff, and it used to go in the dump, and it comes here, and it's perfectly good stuff. They just don't want it. It's not their stuff.
It's a cliche. One person's trash is another one's treasure, but it adds up to big bucks at the thrift shop.
Last year, we gave away $470,000.
The shop gives 10% to the church for outreach and 90% to the community. Dozens of local organizations got grants last year, and yes, they totaled nearly $500,000.
I found it was like a glass goose, and it looked pretty cool.
Are there some clothes in that bag for you?
Yes, a lot.
The thrift store is open all winter, along with a special Christmas shop for the holiday season.
Thank you.
Hey, bye-bye, baby.
Bye.
Bye.
See you later.
Jane Hampton teaches journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and brought us that story on the St. Matthias Thrift Shop in Minocqua. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum. Now, if you live in a big city or you've traveled to one recently, you might have noticed electric scooters buzzing around or just lying on the sidewalk. They're legal here in Wisconsin, and Milwaukee has given the green light for a test run of the scooters that happened earlier this year. Some people swear by them, but not everyone is a fan. And the objections people raise about scooters today have some things in common with the debate over bicycles more than 100 years ago. Clive Thompson is a science and technology journalist. He recently wrote about this for Smithsonian Magazine. Clive, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Let's start in the present day. These scooters, you can find them in almost every big city you go to. They inspire some strong feelings. What's the back and forth with lovers and haters of electric scooters?
Well, the people who love them love the idea that there's all these electric scooters scattered around their town. And anytime they need to go somewhere that's a short distance that would not be easily served by a bus and maybe kind of too too expensive or too short to like take a cab, they can just jump on one of these, and for literally like a dollar or maybe $2, they can go, you know, 10 blocks. So they love that. And they can drop them off anywhere. They're dockless. You don't need to put them back at a dock. So they love the convenience. The people that hate them hate the fact that these scooters are now sort of scattered everywhere in their city, right? You know, because they're dockless, they get left everywhere. They get left, sometimes they fall over. They also don't like that people often ride the scooters on the sidewalk, and they're kind of fast, right? So there's this thing that's coming at you, you know, 15 miles an hour on the sidewalk. So there's just a real fight in the streets of the U.S. right now over this.
And you see some echoes from now back to the 1800s when people were dealing with another two-wheeled invention, the bicycle. What was the deal here? What was the bicycle automatically an everyday transit option? Why were people concerned?
Well, first off, it actually took a long time for the bicycle to kind of emerge. Like, it actually started really like around like the 1810s, but they were really crude. And it wasn't until about 1890 that they basically perfected the bicycle the way that you and I see it today. You know, those nice sort of round inflatable tires and brakes and two wheels. And they called it the safety bicycle because it was safe for anyone to ride. And when they kind of perfected that, started mass marketing it, it really exploded on the streets of the United States. And so suddenly there was just, you know, hundreds and thousands and eventually millions of people riding these things up and down the streets of New York, Boston, Chicago, you know, everywhere. And it really caused a lot of freakouts amongst people. First off, the people that had like livery trucks, you know, that were back then drawn by horses, they hated them because the bicycles just scared the dickens out of the horses. And so the horses were always, you know, sort of whinnying and running away when a bike came down. And so there was fist fights between like livery drivers and bicycles. Like, they would push them into traffic. And then, and back then, as now, it wasn't with these scooters, it wasn't really sure where you should ride your bicycle. Like, does it belong on the road? Does it belong on the sidewalk? So they were being ridden on sidewalks and people were freaking out about that. They also rode them. People like to take them on the weekends and ride them around parks. And people were unaccustomed to that because they were trying to play or relax in parks. And suddenly these sort of daredevils were running around on these fast inventions. And so they were banned like for a long time from Central Park, from other parks here in New York City, other places. So there was just a lot of fights over what is this crazy new thing and how can we live with it?
And people who were against bicycles, they even sometimes called for people to vandalize them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there was calls for them to be, if you see one and it's not locked, just steal it or you know, break the spokes or slash the tires was a common thing. In fact, there was a thing that kids would do, teenage kids would do, or where they would scatter like tacks and glass on the road to try and break the wheels of cyclists. Like, that was sort of a prank, but it was egged on by a society, you know, a significant number of which were extremely annoyed and repelled by these bicycles.
Wow. A pretty contentious sort of situation back in the 1800s with bikes.
Yeah, and the other thing that was interesting, the other thing that caused consternation was with women, right? Because, you know, up until that point in time, women were pretty much wearing, like, petticoats, right? Multi-layered petticoats. And it made it kind of hard to get around. Like, you couldn't walk for very far in those things. So when bicycles came along, it was like this sudden way for young women and middle-aged women, any women, to sort of travel around freely in a really fast way that felt liberating. But because the skirts would actually get messed up, you know, in the spokes, they started wearing bloomers, like, which are these kind of fluffy pants. It was called bifurcated raiment because it, you know, had two legs. And this was scandalous, right? Because society was unaccustomed to seeing women wearing things that even looked like pants. So it caused this, it also caused this revolution, or it aided the revolution that was already happening with the first generation of suffragettes and women's rights. And that, of course, caused people to freak out too, because, like, you know, men would write these editorials going, well, if women are going to wear pants, what makes them different from men? And society's going to fall apart. So it was, you know, the bicycle was had a lot of very interesting side effects.
Well, as a woman wearing pants right now, I think at least that part has been avoided. When you're looking back at this bicycle history, how does it change the way you see electric scooters today and the way that we're talking about them?
Yeah, it in one sense, it gave me some context and maybe gave me some patience, right? Because I think, like other people, I am, you know, alarmed at some of the dangerous way that the scooters have been rolled out and some of the dangerous way that people are riding them, right? Not just danger to other people, running over other people or leaving them in the way of people that are using, you know, crutches or anything like that. But even danger to themselves, because if you ride one of these scooters along like a not very well maintained road with potholes, you can very easily just take like a header. So part of me is like, wow, this is really a mess. And also the business model where it's these companies that are just trying to dump scooters in the streets, like that's sort of the problem we've seen with like Uber inside cities, and so that doesn't portend well. But I will say, when I look back at the bicycle thing, I see, well, you know, sometimes it does take society a decade or two to figure out how to adjust to a new type of mobility, a new technology that lets people go from point A to point B inside a city. It takes a while to figure out the protocols, right? Like it took a while for bicyclists to figure out, okay, we need to be in the streets and not on the sidewalks, and for cities to pass laws and regulations saying that, and for police to start enforcing that, right? And so part of me is like, well, probably the same thing is going to happen with all these quote unquote micromobility technologies, like the little scooters or the larger sort of electric mopeds. So this is all a big hot mess right now. But I actually think it will be possible to figure out the rules of engagement here. I will say it has been heartening to see a bunch of cities, you know, taking action on this, like actually, you know, looking pretty carefully at who's operating and limiting the number of little scooters and things. So that seems good. I think the transition may happen faster this time than it happened with bicycles 100 years ago.
Sure. Combination of public and private and companies and pedestrians, everybody working together. Clive, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it was great.
Clive Thompson is a science and technology journalist, and we were talking about scooters and how the debate sounds a lot like not questionable attitudes toward bicycles in the 19th century. Join us on the Ideas Network tomorrow for live coverage from Washington. The House Judiciary Committee holds a hearing regarding the constitutional grounds for presidential impeachment. Live coverage of that public impeachment inquiry starts Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. And I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You are listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent talks about ideas of mental health and violent crime. Our guest argues there's no factual link between mental illness and gun violence. That conversation and more happen on The Morning Show from 6 until 9. Now, today is Cyber Monday. Millions of people are clicking around the internet for deals on everything from towels to expensive toys. Americans are expected to spend a lot of money this holiday season. The National Retail Federation forecast shows in November and December alone, consumers will likely spend $730 billion. That's about 4% more than last year. Our next guest says the roots of that consumer culture can be traced back to the early 20th century. And yet, she says shopping isn't necessarily as frivolous as we might assume. Tracy Deutsch is an associate professor of history at the University of Minnesota. She focuses on gender and women's studies, the history of consumption, and the history of capitalism. Tracy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, consumerism doesn't just mean buying a lot of stuff. We really need to understand what we're talking about for the rest of this conversation to make sense. What is consumerism?
So consumerism refers to a relatively modern idea that ever-increasing amounts of consumption are good, both for individuals and also for the economy and society at large.
Okay, so we're working with that idea that it is an opportunity, really. A lot of people complain about the way that consumerism gets mixed in with holidays. Let's play a famous line from the movie Miracle on 34th Street that gets at this.
Imagine making a child take something it doesn't want just because he bought too many of the wrong toys. That's what I've been fighting against for years, the way they commercialize Christmas.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad isms floating around this world, but one of the worst is commercialism. Make a buck, make a buck.
You know, that was released in the 1940s. People were upset about this idea even at that time. When did we start to see American consumption transform?
Well, consumption itself became a pretty central part of most people's lives by the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when more and more Americans were both living in urban areas and also reliant on manufactured goods or goods that someone else had produced for their everyday life. So that's a relatively old phenomena. What's interesting to me as a historian is the flip side of that, which is how long people have been anxious about that fact and anxious about the dangers of consumption.
And how long is that then? Tell us more about it.
Honestly, it is even longer than consumption has been a central part of people's lives. So if you go back, I don't know, almost as far as you can go in terms of modern history and the history of capitalism, people, social critics and economists and analysts have expressed concern that consumption was taking over people's lives and cheapening their gifts and turning people away from more virtuous behavior.
But you point out that consumption isn't necessarily, an option for us. We do need to purchase things. Sometimes they're really critical items that we purchase and use. So it's not necessarily this worthless concept. What's your take on that?
So the way I have come to think of consumption is that it's a very important sight in many people's lives, and that what we need to do is to understand it as a complicated sight in which people express their belonging in groups, their individual desires. They negotiate constraints on their lives, like their financial constraints, and they also work out new identities for themselves. So rather than think of consumption as good or bad, I try to encourage folks to think about it as an important, complicated site, much the same way that we think about paid work.
And your background, some of it is in food and food history. So help us with food as an example of something that we consume.
So food, I think, is a really good way of complicating the conversation around consumption, because food isn't an option. We have to consume food. And for almost everyone, that means purchasing food. And thinking about consumption that way helps to break down the binary between good or bad. The question is not, for most people, am I going to eat or not? We hope. Rather, the question is, what are the constraints on my eating? What do I want to eat? What am I after here? And thinking about, so using food to think about consumption, I think, can help to complicate the way we think about consumption itself.
And better help us understand the reality of it, not this kind of dichotomy that we create.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
Tracy Deutsch is an associate professor of history, and she looks at the history of consumption and capitalism. And you're part of this conversation. You can call 800-642-1234. What do you realize about consumerism now that maybe didn't dawn on you until you were older? How do you see it affecting your life this time of year or really any time? You can call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tracy, let's talk about the idea of gender roles and shopping. Early on, there were some pretty set roles. What about that?
So for a long time, consumption was understood as something that fell to women to do as part of their responsibilities for running households. So some of the very first household guides were also guides about what to shop for in different seasons and where to buy it. Obviously, that strict gender binary has broken down over time, although there are still really interesting differences in typically in what men and women are understood to be responsible for. So car ads are more typically geared towards couples or towards men, although not always. And grocery stores are still often imagining their ideal customers as women.
I have to, I'm a little stuck on that word expectations, because I feel like often, you know, there are jokes about women who go shopping, and we don't really apply that to men who go shopping. So there's this negative stereotype in there. But what you're saying is traditionally there was an expectation that women shopped for the goods for the family.
Not only was there an expectation that women shopped, but again, if you think about consumption as a necessary part of running a household, there was a requirement that someone had to shop. For most households, in modern history, some of those goods had to be purchased. So the notion that consumption was voluntary was also a way of criticizing women and kind of putting them in their place in a literal way, reminding them that their work was suspect.
And also, you talk about the fact that social critics and reformers kind of blamed working class women for inflation because they were responsible for the family's spending. Paint that picture for us.
Sure. So during periods of dramatic inflation, for instance, after World War I and again in the 1970s, social critics often blamed consumers and particularly women for paying the higher prices. And they argued that if women simply refused to pay the prices, that they would fall. And while that might make sense if you look at it as a mathematical equation, many women shared their frustration at rising prices. Individual consumer action is not, many other economists pointed out, that individual consumer action was unlikely to solve structural problems involving these periods of massive inflation, which were caused by structural shifts in the economy as much as individual consumer behavior.
So if your family expected certain things, you weren't likely to not get them those things because they were more expensive. That affected your everyday life, and especially if it wasn't going to contribute to a big change nationally, you're not motivated to do that.
Well, and yes, I think that's right. And you could this gets at the ways that consumption is complicated and not a cut and dry activity. You could decide if prices went up not to buy something and then renegotiate the relationships at home and kind of bear the brunt of that. Sometimes that calculation made sense and sometimes it didn't. So if you think about consumption as a place in which people are constantly negotiating all sorts of questions, their identities, what their family wants, how much something costs, I think you can start to see how it's a really weighty, complicated, unstable site.
We're talking to Tracy Deutsch. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Minnesota. She researches gender and consumption. And we're talking about consumer culture in the U.S. as we wrap up one of the biggest shopping weekends of the year. And we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Are the holidays too commercialized in your view? Do you think there's too much emphasis we put on buying stuff in our culture? What about keeping up with the Joneses? Have you ever experienced that or seen people act maybe irresponsibly to try to, be the same as their neighbors? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. We continue our conversation about shopping and American consumer culture now. Tracy Deutsch is with us. She's an expert on the history of consumption, capitalism, and gender at the University of Minnesota. She also earned her graduate degree from UW-Madison here in Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we as Americans consume too much? What feelings does shopping leave you with? Maybe it's a fun social thing you do with friends, or is there a sense of pressure to always have the latest gadget or the latest coat? What questions do you have for Tracy? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Mike in Shorewood now. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my question for your guest is if you could comment on, you know, we've had this shift in capitalism from this model of production to consumption, and when I was in grad school, we talked a lot about consuming to consume. And now with the internet and the way we can 24/7 purchase, I just feel that we've kind of gone down this road. I don't know where we go from here in terms of our consumption levels. We essentially can't turn it off, and everything's geared towards people purchasing and not really thinking often about the consequences of what they're purchasing, whether that's debt or excess or even their ecological footprint.
Mike, thanks for the question. What do you think, Tracy?
So I really hear what you're saying, Mike. I think there's a lot of concern right now particularly around the environmental impact of consuming a lot of goods and excessive purchasing, as well as the financial impact of those things. And obviously, those are issues that we have to ask ourselves as a country some serious questions about. To solve those questions, though, I think we have to remember that consumption is about more than individual desire, that when people are shopping on the internet or incurring a lot of debt, there are reasons. And those reasons might include their desire to give a gift or something they feel like they need for their families or the constraints of being unable to move or get to a store. There could be 1,000 reasons. So my point is just that to tackle something like climate change or environmental crisis, we need to remember that consumers are also people who have those concerns, who think about the environment. Historically, there have been many moments when consumers were mobilized to act in political ways. A good example would be an end to child labor, when there were all kinds of boycotts and organized consumption that sought to reach people and encourage them not to produce goods made by children. And that had a real impact publicly and politically. So there's no reason to think that consumers are only as limited as it can look like they are from online purchases.
You know, Mike also brings up this idea of buying and consuming thoughtlessly. Do we see that? Is it just buying for the sake of buying, or is there more nuance there too?
Well, historians are fond of saying that's outside my time period. But but I would say that typically people usually have an explanation for why they're buying what they're buying. Certainly that explanation can mirror the idea that consumption is thoughtless or apolitical, or people just do it to get a rush from the purchase. And certainly that can happen some of the time. But a lot of times the things that people are buying are things that they have a narrative about, of what this purchase will do for them, of why they want it, of what it will do for their family or their household. And so I think it helps to think about consumers as whole people who are doing things because they believe that this good will help them in some way.
Thanks again for that call, Mike. You can join us at 800-642-1234 as we're talking about modern mass consumption and what that means for us politically, what that means for us socially and economically. Tracy Deutsch is our guide, associate professor of history, and she looks at the history of consumption and capitalism. Tracy, when we're considering this, there's that phrase, keeping up with the Joneses, that I already used. How does consumerism play into that desire for social acceptance?
So one important shift that happened historically was that people's status started to be marked by the goods that they purchased. And this was something that late 19th and early 20th century economists noticed and talked about. Thurstein Veblen is probably the most famous person who talked about the desire of many people to establish themselves socially through the goods they purchased. And therefore, they constantly had to buy new goods in order to keep that status, to keep up with the Joneses, to keep up with their neighbors. That's in some ways a really old and defining feature of modern consumption. It certainly hasn't gone away. I think people feel it to varying degrees, and it can have some unpredictable effects. So for some people, keeping up with the Joneses can involve not buying things but not flaunting them, displaying them in understated ways. or buying things that you think will reflect the values of people around you.
All right. Let's bring Danny in Ontario, Wisconsin, into the conversation. Danny, what are your thoughts?
Hi. Thanks for having me. I guess my comment on the conversation would be living in a little more remote location or rural Wisconsin, it's really been an added benefit for our family to have these on-demand shopping experiences rather than taking, you know, a family trip to the nearest city to buy something that we otherwise could get, you know, next day shipping. So our family has really benefited of getting more valuable time together out of it.
Interesting. So you're not spending time on the road going to those places. Danny, thanks for that. Tracy, what do you hear there?
So I hear, again, a great example of the ways that people's consumption reflects all kinds of desires and values, including, you know, in this case, it's a great example of how buying online can actually, in some ways, increase the time you spend at home with your family rather than traveling to go out and shop.
Sure. What about the relationship between our mass consumption, this consumerism, and power?
So I think that mass consumption is kind of a misnomer because mass consumption, these sort of icons of mass consumption like malls or supermarkets or a place like Amazon, are also things that people have to work to get access to. For a long time, department stores in this country were racially segregated. Many people were excluded from shopping there. And even when they weren't legally segregated, they have often been exclusionary just because of the prices they charge or the different levels that people were sort of shuttled to, depending on their incomes and their interests. So mass consumption, being able to engage with mass consumption in and of itself is a way of showing, in the United States, a way of showing your belonging, a way of showing your citizenship, and a way of participating in modern public life. It's not something that just happens. It's something that for many people, they use as a marker of their authority and their power.
What about how our government systems or people regulate businesses or institute policy? Because I can imagine that if people are buying more, relying on that more, then it would be important that what we're consuming is fair, accurate, right. How do we deal with regulation and who gets the say in that?
So that's been a kind of bugbear of consumer politics for a very long time, because if you imagine that consumption reflects what people want and that it should be a realm of sort of unregulated desire and people just get what they want, it can be hard to justify a regulation, something that puts a limit on what people want. And that's the argument that was used against consumer regulations in the 1980s when many of these were rolled back. In fact, though, there's a very long history to health and safety regulations of consumer goods, much longer than most people realize. Even in the 19th century, localities often regulated the amount that could be charged for certain goods, the quality that goods had to have. So it's not a new idea to suggest that consumer goods need to be regulated. In the early 20th century, the federal government started to step in and pass laws regulating goods, and those have had a really dramatic effect on the safety of everyday items that we often take for granted. I am old enough that I remember the threat of cars that would, the Pintos that famously would explode occasionally. It was regulations that stopped that from happening and stopped manufacturers from being able to pass off
sure.
products like that.
All right. Tracy, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
That was Tracy Deutsch, Associate Professor of History at the University of Minnesota. We were talking about the rise of American consumer culture and its effect on our personal, social, and political lives. And coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about it in just a moment.
Days from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow, State Senator Chris Larson joins the program to talk about a bill in the Wisconsin legislature that requires baby-changing stations in all public restrooms. Some places put them only in women's bathrooms. Join us on the morning show tomorrow at 7 o'clock. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we're talking Wisconsin brands with cult-like followings. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is Central Time.